A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories on KSL News Radio.
I know Andy Farnsworth certainly has his eyes on that snarled traffic issue at the point of the mountain. We're looking at a monitor right here. We see you. So just stay with us. Hang with us. Andy will be jumping in and out, of course, as he always does with the latest on that. We've just had kind of a slew of different traffic-related issues, not necessarily all snow-related. We had that horrible crash, front runner crashing into a cyclist this morning at about 6 o'clock. We're going to have UTA join us in the show to give us the latest on what happened in the downtown area this morning.
And if you live in the Davis County area, you'll remember yesterday was an absolute nightmare from 2:30 until 8:30, at least 8:30. There was a semi-crash. And it had backed things up for hours. It's 9:08. It's time for the launch.
Sequence engaged.
And here are three things that Debbie wants you to know.
Countdown. Three.
We're on water watch. 10:05 this morning, the 700 inches of snow at Brighton Ski Resort in Big Cottonwood Canyon. And we're reporting this morning on Utah's Morning News. There's lots of water in that snowpack. So we're going to go in-depth with KSL meteorologist Kevin Eubank on that. And then we're going to bring emergency preparedness folks into the conversation on flood insurance. Even if you don't live in a designated flood zone, is this something you can purchase in case you're worried, or is it too late?
Yeah, I wonder how many pieces of insurance do I need? Fire, flood, earthquake. There seems to be a never-ending supply of insurance out there for me. Which one do I really need? Because right now, I'm looking up in those mountains. I'm feeling these snowstorms. Flood is at the top of the list.
Countdown.
How about at 9:35 we go live to Mar-a-Lago, where former President Trump is on arrest watch. Don't know if he will be arrested, but he thinks he will be arrested. New York grand jury, as we talked about yesterday, hearing the last of a witness testimony in the case involving some hush money to an adult film star by the name of Stormy Daniels. Now, if the grand jury finds evidence that President Trump was aware the $130,000 in payments were made to keep her quiet during the 2016 election, well, I don't know if we'll have the president hauled off in handcuffs, but he could be delivered a summons to appear.
I do wonder, I'm trying to figure out, okay, it's creepy, right? $130,000 in hush money, don't tell about our secret affair. I mean, that's creepy, no question. Was it illegal? Was it criminal? I still don't know what's wrong with these payments. I remember Bill Clinton paid Paula Jones $850,000 to settle a sexual harassment suit. Like, when is it appropriate? When is it illegal? We'll try to figure out those questions because I'm still scratching my head.
Launch countdown one.
Someone wants the Bible removed from Davis County school libraries. That's the headline in the Deseret News and on KSL.com. And it's our top story, as we're going to go in-depth on why the challenge was made, how this review process works at the district level, and if the reviewers will have to read all 1,200 pages of the most storied book in history.
The Bible is the most produced book in history. It's the most read book in history.
Deb, when you told me about this story, they want the Bible removed from Davis County school libraries, I about detached a retina, rolling my eyes. I mean, that it was like a full-on retinal detachment. It was incredible. Obviously, this is retaliation. You bend one of my books, I'm going to bend one of your books. Is it going to be banned? We'll dive into it.
Dave and Dijanovic.
The launch.
Commence.
Dave and Dijanovic.
Dave and Dijanovic.
Special coverage of the top local story.
I want to know which passage or passages triggered this challenge. We don't know who is challenging it, but we do know the challenge was filed in December. Thanks to the reporting by KSL.com and also the Deseret News teamed up for this story. Hopefully we can find out over the next 20 minutes of our coverage which passages actually triggered this challenge to the Bible.
I know of a few passages that triggered me when I was reading it. You read about Sodom and Gomorrah and then Lot and his daughters. That was a little, you know, like that was a little weird to read in the Bible. Should it be banned? Should we get it out of schools? No, I mean, that's silly, but I want to find out more about this story.
So usually when we hear about these book challenges, and there are more and more book challenges, we're going to dive into that in just a few minutes. You can't believe how many challenges these districts are getting. It's usually about LGBTQ or race issues. This time it's the Bible's turn. And we do know that that the districts have set up committees in to review these books. Because can you imagine trying to read?
Impossible. Right,
1,200 pages. When I read it many years ago in my 30s, and it took me an entire summer. And you have to, it's like, it's, it,
it,
you
it
can't
can be
read.
A slog at sometimes. At times.
You cannot sit down and say,
easy reading.
Page turner, I'm reading this all in one weekend. It's bits and pieces, right?
You don't think the Bible's a page turner?
No, it's just not one of those books. You have to and I think you have to digest it slowly, right? But there are 15 different committees in your school district alone, which is where this challenge is happening, Dave, in the Davis district, set up to handle all of the protests or challenges that they're getting to these books.
Yeah, it's an important conversation because there are certainly books that are appropriate, that are age appropriate, I should say. There are books out there that I do not want my 12-year-old reading right now. Not that I don't want them reading them ever, you know, a lot like movies. There's a rating system, there's appropriate movies. Same thing for books. I don't know why all of a sudden this is like a super edgy conversation to have, to think that there's age appropriate books, age appropriate movies, age appropriate music. But that's what's happening right now.
And libraries, even school libraries, serve all, right? I mean, and there's usually like a, you know, like middle school library and a high school library and then a grade school library. So
they're different. They carry different books.
Sure,
absolutely.
Sure. So it's just the Bible. It's not the Quran or the Book of Mormon. It's just the Bible. And you had said something when we were having a discussion as we're coming into studio about, in your mind, certain books of historical proportion kind of get a pass in a way, right?
Yeah, no question. I think of Huckleberry Finn, right? I mean, that is a classic, but it uses language that we would never use now, right? But do you give a pass because in the time it was written, it was appropriate or important? I don't know. I understand, you know, if it's the same rule for this book, it should be the same rule for that book. I understand the argument, but it does, at the same time, it is a stretch.
So which passages sparked this challenge? We're going to ask KSL.com reporter Amy Donaldson, who broke this story along with Deseret News reporter Marjorie Cortez. But Amy's joining the show in just a moment. I mean, is it Genesis chapter 38 verses 12 through whatever, or is it Revelation chapter 17 verses 1, or is it just a secret? Is it just a secret, and the school districts won't share with us, or the school district won't share with us which passages in the Bible came under fire? But we'll ask Amy Donaldson straight ahead.
Dave and Dijanovic.
Dave and Dijanovic.
Special coverage of the top local story.
The Bible is the most produced book in history. It's the most read book in history.
But someone out there wants it banned from school library shelves. Here's the article. It's a collaboration between KSL.com and the Deseret News that we're diving into. The headline says, "Somebody wants the Bible removed from Davis County school libraries.
They find it inappropriate. Now, what is appropriate is a moving target. Well, what is appropriate for one parent might not be appropriate for another. I remember taking my son to Iron Man. He was pretty young. And as I'm watching the movie with him and Iron Man is mowing through a camp full of terrorists, I had this moment of self-reflection thinking, what are we doing here? Like, this is probably not great for a young child. So other people might feel differently, right? We have this sliding scale of what we think is appropriate.
Yeah, we'll get into the particulars with Amy Donaldson of KSL.com. She's one of two reporters who broke this story. The other is Marjorie Cortez with the Deseret News. And just reading the article, I've read it a few times now, just make sure I'm reading it correctly. It looks as though this challenge happened in December, early December, which makes me wonder if the committee that's been in charge of reading this 1,200-page historical piece of work is close to meeting its 60 days, its business days, for review. I don't think they work on weekends and holidays. So let's bring on Amy Donaldson at KSL.com. Great report, Amy. I know you worked really hard on this with Marjorie Cortez over at the Deseret News, read through it. Just off the bat, do we know what passages are being challenged? Has the district released that information to you?
No, actually in the Davis County district, so every district makes their own rules of how to deal with book challenges. And in the Davis district, they do not make the names of the challengers public, nor sort of what they're are they challenging a specific passage, or are they you can also challenge a book based on its theme, like the overarching theme of this book is too mature for a kid of 15 or whatever. So we don't know. It's not public.
Is it challenged in all schools or like just elementary schools?
So the committee will consider whether or not it's appropriate for any school age kid. And so a couple of books have been retained in high schools only. We don't know where the challenge comes from. Did it come from an elementary school parent? And because of a change in the state law last year, anyone can make a challenge. So I don't have kids in the school. I could make a challenge because I don't like a book at my high school library.
Do they have to be a Utah resident, or can they be from anywhere in the country?
You know, I don't know that it specifies that,
okay.
But I think part of the issue was that they said there are staff members like a superintendent or a school board member who don't have children in a specific school who may have an issue with something that's being, loaned out to kids. So that's sort of the thinking behind it. We don't even know if the book has been checked out. That's the thing I looked into when I did the story on the Canyons District a couple of years ago. Most of the books that were being challenged had never even been checked out. So I don't know if anyone's checking out the Bible. Maybe this is going to make a run on the Bible. I tend to see this a little bit the way Dave does, and that it's likely not a genuine challenge. Now, it could be. I'm not saying it's not, but we have no way to ask the person. See, in the past, I've been able to call the person making the challenge because Canyons makes those names public.
So some districts do it differently.
Say, Yeah, what's happening? And so, but when you don't know, you're just guessing. But I wonder if we're going to see a whole rash of challenges that are, I don't want to see Barack Obama's autobiography at my kid's school. I don't want to see Ronald Reagan's autobiography at my school. You know, I wonder if you're just going to see a bunch of challenges that are like, hey, if you're going to be offended by this, I'm offended by that. So I don't know.
Amy Donaldson.
I worry about that.
Amy Donaldson with KSL.com. She's one of two reporters who broke the story about the Davis School District reviewing a challenge to the Bible. All 1,200 pages of it. We don't know if it's that or if it's specific passages. Amy's just filling us in on the details that she's learned in her reporting. So let's say the committee that's in charge of reading the Bible to see if it needs to be banned in the Davis School District, Amy, decides, yeah, it needs to be banned. It needs to be removed from library shelves. Does that just impact Davis County Schools?
Yes.
Or is that a statewide ban then?
No, they only have the authority in their own district. So it just means the Bible would be removed from schools in Davis County. And they could say, we can only have the Bible at high schools, no Bible in elementary school or vice versa. So they can make it. It's interesting to note in Davis has had so many challenges that Christopher Williams said they formed 15 committees just to deal with these. And these people are working on nights and weekends, and the district has to buy them the books that are challenged. Most of them don't have the book. So it's a significant impact on what we're asking of our educators and parents and people who are already involved in the school community. I think some people think it's worth it. I look at some of it, like what Dave's saying, everyone's, you know, offended by different things. I mean, art is what it is, and it's made in the time that it's made. And so Huckleberry Finn is going to offend somebody now. I go to plays, like I went to Carousel, and I'm like, this play is about domestic violence, and I don't really like how they characterize domestic violence, right? But it's made in the moment it's made, and so you're not going to, you know, you can't change it. It's just, because it was made in that moment. It's just, right. It's a really, I think you're just getting into really, I don't know, dangerous area when you start.
It's also tricky
like
because
that.
we have seen Roald Dahl. Some of his books have been changed and manipulated to be more, I don't know, friendly, inclusive, less offensive. I think we're kind of in this world right now, Debbie and Amy, where we're not quite sure what to do with these books.
Well, and I would just say, I think we've always had, there's always been banned books. There's always been, you know, art that's caused us trouble. That's the purpose of art. Art is supposed to make you think. It's supposed to make you look at something differently. It's supposed to challenge you. And so if you don't like something, then don't consume it. And the thing that's mind-boggling to me is that this has become such a hot issue for parents. And most kids are not checking books out of the library.
They might not be checking them out, but that's not to say they're not skittering over
Amy,
and looking
at
them.
I think your point earlier that you can't even know for sure if the Bible has been checked out. I guess we also don't know if the person who submitted the challenge has actually sat down and read it, or if they're just picking passages offline and submitting their concerns over some of the passages.
That's the other concern. Most of the parents, and I've talked to a few of them that have made challenges, they are not reading the books that they are challenging. There's videos out there that tell you which books you should challenge and what passages and what the issues are. And for some people, like there are movies I have heard about that I know what the problem is, why it's rated R or whatever. And I'm not a shrinking violet or anything, but I don't want to go to that. I don't want to see that. So I just don't go. I don't worry about it. If someone else wants to go to it, right? But we have a rating system set up. Maybe we need something like that with books. But honestly, kids are not consuming books the way I wish they would. So they're not using the library system the way that we think they are. But it's a really critical role that libraries play, because not only are they like just the keepers of history and the keepers of art, like they need to be there. But there are people who don't have digital access, their parents can't go buy them a book at the local bookstore. And so, I mean, the fact that there are these texts available are really critical. And you may hate the Bible. You may never want to read it. My guess is a lot of kids are now going to be searching through the Bible. What might be?
Thanks, Amy.
Let's get the salacious stuff from the
Amy
from the
Donaldson
Bible.
Of KSL.com. You can read the article at KSL.com or also at DeseretNews.com. And great reporting. The article is very in-depth. We are going to have a live conversation with Chris Williams. You heard Amy mention his name, a spokesperson for the Davis District, in the 11 o'clock hour. Need to ask him that important question, like, when will the review be wrapped up?
Yeah, and I want to learn more about these committees. How do they function? Is it a committee of two? Is it a committee of 20?
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Dave and Dujanovic, special coverage of the top national story.
Former President Donald Trump thinks today is the day that he will be arrested. Possible charges brought forth through an indictment and through the Manhattan District Attorney's Office.
Yeah, this is part of that Stormy Daniels case, you know, where Trump allegedly had an affair with a porn star, paid her $130,000 to keep it quiet.
And we don't know if it's going to happen today, but he said so on his social media platform, Truth Social. He said he made his arrest prediction a couple of days ago. Several prominent leaders of the Republican Party have denounced this as political prosecution. So here's former Vice President Mike Pence.
It reeks of the kind of political prosecution that we endured back in the days of the Russia hoax.
And then current governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis.
Or as Trump likes to call him, Ron DeSanctimonious.
I have no interest in getting involved in some type of manufactured circus by some Soros DA.
And I think a lot of Republicans are kind of in this weird world right now. Mike Pence is probably going to run for president, or Ron DeSantis likely as well. And now you're in a situation where typically you would let the competition just flounder, just let them get destroyed. Mm. But because of the popularity of the former president, they have to come out in support. But not too much support.
Yeah, but I don't know if they're supporting him as much as they are pointing the finger at the Manhattan district attorney and accusing him of playing politics with the grand jury investigation. We know that yesterday, we believe that the grand jury wrapped up witness testimony. And then President Trump had indicated that he felt he could be arrested today. I'd find that timeline kind of shocking in terms of grand jury standard time. Usually what happens is they take months of testimony, lots of evidence, and then they look over it for a while, like any jury would do, right? I mean, but I'd be shocked if it were today. But Brian Etten with News Nation, he's a senior national correspondent in Florida at Mar-a-Lago. You are on, I'll just say, arrest watch, it sounds like. Have you seen any sign of the president, with his his manifestation coming true this morning that he could be arrested today?
Yeah, you're right. We're on arrest watch, basically. Our sources are telling us that it's likely not going to happen today, that the grand jury might make a decision tomorrow, that's a possibility. We know that the former president is at Mar-a-Lago, where I am. It's been very, very quiet for the most part, maybe a couple of dozen protesters have come out today with Trump flags and that sort of thing. We've also been over at the airport where his 757 is, just to see if they're getting ready to move that at all. It seems to be pretty calm over there too. So for the most part, everybody's just sort of just waiting at this point down here.
What do we know about the Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg? Ron DeSantis, Governor DeSantis, calls him a George Soros backed DA. What do we know about Alvin Bragg?
Well, he's serving his first term right now as DA in New York City. He is the first black man ever to serve in that role. He's Harvard educated. He worked for the attorney general in New York before being elected. He sort of has a long history with Trump. He claims that when he was working for the attorney general's office, he assisted in 100 different lawsuits targeting Trump or the Trump organization. I was going through his campaign ads yesterday just to try to get some perspective when he was running in 2020, and he even featured Ivanka and Eric Trump in one of his ads, had their video of them up in one of his ads and said that he would always hold the powerful accountable. So it seems like he's, for a long time, had the Trumps in his orbit. In terms of, his job as the DA in New York, it's been somewhat controversial because he himself admits he's a very, very progressive DA, very into bail reform, not prosecuting lower level crimes, not, jailing people for lower level crimes. Crime was up, I think, about 22% last year overall in New York City. So he's been somewhat controversial there.
Brian Enten is on, he's at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. He's on arrest watch to see if the president, former President Donald Trump, is taken into custody. And you said that maybe tomorrow, that the grand jury may either hand up an indictment or just decline an indictment. Brian, it could go either way. And you said it's pretty quiet except for a few protesters. And I'm reviewing some other news articles about online chatter on this. It seems as though the President Trump is having a little bit of a struggle, at least from an online perspective, of clamoring support behind him for protests if he is indeed arrested. What are you seeing? It seems like the online chatter is very kind of disorganized, kind of unfocused. Don't really know if he's going to have the same kind of crowd that he had, for example, on January 6th a couple of years ago show up.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's pretty quiet out here. I'm actually watching another truck right now go by with Trump flags. You know, there was a plan originally that a lot of people were going to meet out here at 10 a.m. this morning. You know, it's now 11:45 local time, and it doesn't seem like a huge crowd has turned out. Granted, the arrest hasn't happened. He hasn't been indicted, so maybe things would change if that happens. I've been outside Mar-a-Lago a lot for other stories. And generally, the crowds here are very peaceful. You know, they come out and, you know, some of them have bullhorns or they'll have flags. And they're, you know, hardcore Trump supporters. But it's not usually like a violent crowd out here or anything like that. We're just kind of waiting. But it doesn't appear to be very organized at this point.
Is there a sense what the likely charge would be?
You know, it has to do with obviously with the payment made through Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels. We don't know exactly. There's a couple of charges that could apply. We don't know exactly which one the grand jury would possibly indict on. But it's interesting, you know, this has obviously been, it's been a while. I mean, this has been in the news for a while. The Justice Department decided not to pursue charges with this specific incident. It'll be interesting to see the way it plays out over the next couple of days.
Brian Enten, thank you for joining us from Florida at Mar-a-Lago on arrest watch from News Nation. Thank you for joining us, senior national correspondent.
We're going to jump back into this conversation at 10:35 with Professor James Curry at the University of Utah. His particular knowledge regarding, you know, Congress, and I've noticed that some congressional leaders have started to take a stand on this. And so we'll ask him what their role could possibly be to protect President Trump or not. More of that conversation straight ahead in our 10 o'clock hour. But for now, we're going to jump out to a conversation regarding this front runner crash that we saw happen this morning. Reddit downtown, Dave, a cyclist was killed by a front runner train. And we're also going to visit more information about a crash that you had up in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, it was that I-15 Davis County crash. The semi that was involved hit a car, and it had taken hours and hours to either clean up or clear the traffic. I was seeing traffic for miles and miles, dead stop parking lot at 8:30 at night when the crash happened at 2. So it was incredible to see. We'll get more information on what happened.
We have a developing story on the front runner train. It happened this morning about 600 West and 4th South. We're going to get Utah Transit Authority into the conversation in just a moment. But we do know that the cyclist who was on the tracks in that area was killed this morning, Dave.
Yeah, Deb, this is one of the things that really scares me. I've done this so often. I take public transit all the time, and I do get a little bit worried about how aware I am. When you're doing something so often, when you're traveling, you know, whether it's walking or biking, and you've got trains coming and buses, it's easy to lose and stop paying attention. I don't know exactly what happened in this case specifically, but there's been several times when I'm walking around the track station that I am not paying nearly the attention I need to.
Carl, are you there?
I am, and you've got to pay attention.
Carl Arkey, spokesperson for the Utah Transit Authority. Let's walk through what happened this morning. And first of all, let's let our listeners know, is Front Runner back online in terms of its of running?
Not full speed, but reduced speeds. And it'll take a little time to catch up and get back on schedule.
Can you walk us through what happened this morning?
Best we know is a gentleman who was, and I don't know where he entered the alignment. The alignment is where the tracks run, and it's the dedicated land that we have for the tracks that run north and south. And I don't know where he got into the alignment. It's obviously not an area where there is a crossing with crossing gates and with lights and bells and all those types of things. So he entered an area that he wasn't supposed to be in, which I know it sounds harsh, but technically it's considered trespassing. And so it was a dark area, I'm sure. It wasn't lit. It's not an area that the train operator was expecting anybody to be. Why he didn't see or hear the train, hard to say. The train has a huge light on the front of it and hard to miss. And plus, if you get that close to it, you should be able to hear it. So not sure exactly. He was walking, I believe, on an eastbound direction, crossing tracks. And it's tragic. It's tragic anytime this happens. And, you know, your heart goes out to it. We don't know the exact circumstances surrounding this particular individual. And with no identification on him, it's going to take some time to track down the next of kin. But our heart obviously goes out to his friends and his family.
Carl, can you give us an idea how long it takes for some of these big moving trains to stop?
If it's going full speed, about 79 miles an hour, if they throw the brakes on, I mean, just jam them on, it will take at least a mile, maybe a little bit more, for that train to come to a complete stop. There is no way. There is no way to stop it immediately. You cannot stop on a dime, and you can't change direction. You're going where you're going, and it's going to take a while to get that train slowed down.
Carl Arkey with the Utah Transit Authority. We're talking to him live this morning because there was this terrible situation on involving Front Runner and a cyclist. Happened about 6 o'clock this morning. The cyclist was killed. Carl, before we let you go, I think that's excellent information in terms of how long it could take a train to stop. It takes up to a mile. Does the conductor have any indication of, I mean, I think about 6 o'clock this morning, it was dark outside. Any indication that something might be on the tracks up ahead? Is there any sort of technology that way? Or is it just like cross your fingers and hope there's nobody on those train tracks as you come into town?
You know, I'm sure there probably is some technology that's being developed now. And in the future, it will be probably throughout the industry. But basically, you know, the operators are really good at focusing on that track and what's ahead of them. That being said, this is a section of track that there is really no expectation that anything or anyone is going to be there. And you can imagine, I mean, these people are operating these trains at various different speeds, sometimes top speed. This train was going about 30 miles an hour because it was coming into Salt Lake Central. Mm-hmm. But even at 30 miles an hour, that's pretty fast. But they're going all the way from Ogden to Provo, Provo to Ogden. That's a lot of ground. That's a lot of terrain. And, you know, you try to keep your eyes out and stay focused. And they're very good at that. But when you don't anticipate somebody being there, obviously when you're coming into a crossing, you're anticipating, okay, there may be something here. We got to pay attention. And they know more about it than I do, that there are certain areas where you have to really keep your ears open, your eyes open, and watch for certain things. But for a 100-mile stretch to be able to see everything and to see that in the dark, pretty tough to do.
Yeah, it's dark out there.
Carl Arkey, thank you for joining us, spokesperson for UTA. And, Debbie, nobody can look a mile ahead. It doesn't matter what conductor you have. No one can look that far ahead. If that's how long it takes to stop, whether it's a half mile, a mile, even, you know, 400 yards. It's impossible to see that far.
There was a pretty big crash up in your neck of the woods yesterday on I-15 near Kaysville. I want to play this from Mark Jackson, KSL News Radio, who covered the story.
UHP Sergeant Cameron Roden tells KSL 5 a semi-truck hit a car in the northbound lanes around 200 North Kaysville Monday afternoon during rush hour. The woman inside that car was pinned and had to be extricated.
There's just so much going on, and her to be able to walk away from that without any serious injuries is, you know, very good that we can end it that way and not something more tragic.
Hours later, all lanes were finally cleared. Dash cam video sent to KSL 5 shows the dramatic accident that lasted about 12 seconds as that big rig pushed the passenger car into the Jersey barrier. You can see that video posted right now at KSLNewsRadio.com. Mark Jackson, KSL News Radio.
So what I'm, my read of this, Dave, from a KSL.com article or KSLNewsRadio.com article is that the semi-truck didn't see that car as it was changing lanes. Of course, we know there was some bad weather up there as well, but pinned it in. So you live up there. You said it was a nightmare.
I was minutes before the crash. I mean, minutes before the crash on I-15, I was coming southbound.
You got past it before it happened?
No, it just happened.
I see. Okay.
In fact, I was only backed up maybe a mile or so before I was able to exit. But the storm came in from the west side. I was in Syracuse at the time. And within minutes, we went from, you know, kind of blue skies essentially to wind immediately, and then just an all-out snowstorm where there were inches dropping. So it was right during this time that the crash happened. So you're dealing with not only the crash, but the weather had come in, the snow had started falling. What shocked me, though, is when it happened so early in the afternoon, I was playing pickleball, you know, until about 8:30. And I was shocked. It was still backed up. And as we heard from that report, 9:15 until all lanes were clear. It happened, what, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon?
Yeah, quite a day up there. Thankfully, the driver of that car who had to be extricated.
Incredible.
Sounds like, yeah. Straight ahead, with all this rain and snow that we've had, we know it's not over yet. Kevin Eubank joining the show to tell us what's in store. And also, we're going to talk about flood insurance. Can you buy it if you don't live in a flood zone? We'll find out.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news. Utah's Water Watch, special coverage on KSL News Radio.
Spring is finally here, but you may need to be bracing yourself for not only more rain or snow, but also potential flooding from all of the precipitation that we've had over the past few months. And it just isn't going anywhere.
One of our neighbors came down and picked up some sandbags a couple of days ago, made the rest of us aware of it. And so we're just trying to make sure we have enough for the neighborhood because we're bound to need them.
More rain ahead.
Yeah. And one of the things I've learned as a homeowner, you learn so many things the hard way. But there is a saturation point when it comes to your ground. And when you reach that saturation point, that water just does not always do what you want it to do. And for some reason, it finds its way into basements, and it's a nightmare. It's such a hassle.
Kevin Eubank, KSL meteorologist. I think we're cheering that Brighton Ski Resort has 700 inches, something of that. Of that amount, which is a lot. But I also heard in our coverage this morning during Utah's Morning News that snow has a significant amount of water in it, which is awesome, but can also be a little bit daunting for those who are in its path.
Sure. You know what? The good news is, guys, we've been talking about this for a long time, right? We've had multi-year droughts, and this is how you recover. So you're right, Debbie. We have record snow in the mountains. We have record snowpack in the mountains. But the best complement to all this is we have record low reservoir levels. So we have more capacity than we've ever had before to handle the more snow than we've ever had before. So it really is a pretty good scenario. But you're right, and Dave's right, soil only can hold so much water. And if it hits that saturation point or we just bring too much water down too fast, it's definitely going to cause problems. But snowpack across the state, to give you a perspective, 150% of normal to 260% of normal. So we're talking 1.5 to 2 times what we typically would see this time of year with the water in the snow. That's where we are. So we are well above normal.
Where do you think we're going to see these reservoirs fill up the best? Or are we going to see Bear Lake that has been receding for years? Are we going to see that come up and you know, fill in a lot of those big empty shores?
Sure. Every reservoir in Utah is going to get near capacity with the exception of Lake Powell. So Flaming Gorge will almost fill Utah Lake, Willard Bay, Pine View. These reservoirs, you know, the small reservoirs, super easy to fill. When you're talking Jordanelle and Rockport and, you know, these Echo, these small ones will just super easy to fill. But the big ones, you know, Utah Lake, Willard Bay, Flaming Gorge, you know, Lake Powell is 22% of capacity. So it's going to take years and years and years to fill that. But almost every other reservoir across the state, we will have the ability to get those near full just through water management, Bear Lake included. So the good news is we've got the infrastructure to move water from high reservoirs to low reservoirs and from elevations in the state to mid and central elevations. So we really have a good water movement network in place. It's just about management and timing. So a lot of those reservoirs are letting water out now in anticipation of water that will be coming in the spring runoff. And that is a very tricky game. I don't, you know, envy many jobs here in Utah, but the one that I do not envy at all is water managers, because yes, that is a horrible, horrible job to manage.
So true. I thought the very thing. Kevin Eubank, thanks for joining us. My goodness. Yeah. When you are letting water out of an already empty or very low reservoir, kind of crossing your fingers that it's going to just fill up, it is. That has got to be an absolute nightmare job right now. Kevin Eubank, thank you.
I want to flip the phone line over to Wade Matthews, who's a spokesperson for the Utah Division of Emergency Management. And let's talk about prepping for flood. And the question that's been on my mind, Wade, is if I don't live in a flood zone, but I can see what's coming in the next few weeks, can I go out and buy flood insurance through my insurance agent? How does that work?
Absolutely. Yes, you can. And we encourage everybody to go in and research that, because everybody is a potential risk right now for flooding. We don't know when or where, but everybody should kind of be ready for that. And yeah, you can get this information at floodsmart.gov. And yeah, it's available at more than 50 insurance companies and thousands of independent agents across the country. But they help administer the National Flood Insurance Program, which is available for homes, businesses. Even if you're a renter, you can get policies that cover your contents.
What is the most common type of flooding? Sometimes we have in our brains that it's just going to be, 4 feet deep in our home. What's the most common kind of flooding that we see?
I think the kind that we need to worry about that can cause the damage we're talking about is that high spring runoff, when the rivers and streams are overflowing their banks, and then now they're running down streets, they're running through neighborhoods, and they're going to the low places, they're going to window wells, they're going to basement doorways, and they are filling up homes that way. We also see sheet flooding, which is, as Kevin was explaining, the ground just can't hold any more water, and it just starts filling up a field. This is kind of a strange phenomenon, but sheet flooding is also, we've also seen that already this year. Flash flooding, of course, is dangerous if you're out in the outdoors. But, it's that high spring runoff that we're concerned about.
Wade Matthews with us right now. He's a spokesperson for the Utah Division of Emergency Management. We're talking about the potential for spring runoff, which could turn into some flooding. And I went to floodsmart.gov and it frequently asked questions section. Wade, it said, question, I already have a homeowner's policy. Answer, most homeowners' insurance does not cover flood damage. Only flood insurance covers the cost of rebuilding after a flood. Bet you a lot of people don't know that, Wade.
That's absolutely right, and that's why we're trying to include that messaging this year so much. And they don't realize that. They think they've got homeowner's insurance, they're covered, but that's not the case. And you know, this flood insurance from the National Flood Insurance Program covers flood damage, and including the sewer damage if it's caused by flood waters is also covered by this National Flood Insurance policy program. Something to remember is, you know, just 1 inch of water in your basement can cause more than $25,000 in damages. And so if you're even just getting a little bit, this type of insurance policy will pay for itself.
Wade, remind me, where do we go to see if our home's in a flood area?
Floodhazards.utah.gov. That's our website through Division of Emergency Management. And there are buttons there to help you find out what your specific flood risk is. And a national flood insurance policy is based on the value of your home and the flood risk. That's what they take into consideration when they are planning your policy. But you can find that at floodhazards.utah.gov.
So that for the flood zone or to see where our house sits, and then floodsmart.gov to find out if we to buy a policy.
Yeah, it'll okay. Just ask you to plug in your state, and it'll give you a list of insurance agents you can talk to.
Okay, I see that right here. Super simple. We'll package all of this up and put this on KSLNewsRadio.com so it makes it one-stop shopping for our listeners. Thanks so much, Wade Matthews with the Utah Division of Emergency Management.
I think a lot of us will look in our neighborhoods and think, oh, I'm on a little bit of a hill. There's no way I'm going to get flooded. That's exactly what goes on in my mind. I thought that until my neighbor had one of those above-ground pools that sprung a leak, and it just channeled the path straight into my basement. I'm like, my goodness, I thought I was totally safe.
It's probably not going to be covered under, you know, the National Flood Insurance Program, Dave. Your neighbor's homeowners might kick in, but that does create quite a mess, having been the subject of multiple basement floods for different reasons other than runoff, including broken sprinklers. I don't know, somebody left a hose running once. It is a pain. Boy, wouldn't it be nice to have insurance if that does happen, because it can get costly to repair that damage. Straight ahead, we're going to continue on our discussions about all the snow talk we're having, because we know a lot of people are seeing carports collapses. We have some roof damage. Maybe you're getting a leak in your roof because of the snow that's been sitting on it. There's ice damming. Thank goodness for KSL TV's investigative reporter, Matt Gephardt. He has been looking into this to tell us what insurance covers and what it doesn't cover when it comes to snow damage. He's walking in studio next.
Utah's Water Watch, special coverage on KSL News Radio.
It's been a long winter. My goodness. We just heard from Kevin Eubank. It's a good thing because we're going to fill up all the reservoirs. We also heard from Wade Matthews with Emergency Management, said you could look into flood insurance even if you don't live in a flood zone. And right now we're going to talk to KSL Television's investigative reporter Matt Gephardt about what insurance covers from all of the damage that people are seeing.
I do wonder how many groundhogs saw their shadow, because it is never ending. I could not believe yesterday that snowstorm that came in, it just dropped. My goodness.
Out of nowhere.
It was like beautiful.
My daughter called me when I was in the thick of it on I-15, and I-15 was turning into what I thought was going to be an ice skating rink. And she said, where in the world did this come from? But it doesn't seem to stop. Have you had any damage at your house, Dave?
No damage. Oddly enough, we've had just the right amount. Enough to enjoy, but not to be miserable.
Matt Gephardt, KSL Television's investigative reporter, running in here from the I-Team office. Thanks for joining us.
Morning. How are you?
Good. So you're looking into this, and you find what kind of damage as you are listening to people's snow stories?
The big one that we've seen a lot of this year is what they call ice dams, right? So where it thaws and freezes and thaws and freezes.
You need heat tape for that.
Heat tape will do some good, but you know, heat tape will only do so much against against this nonsense. So I've got a buddy who actually used to be a KSL photographer who lives has a place up in Deer Valley now, and he, you know, he's had the whole ice dam the water gets up under his shingles, got into his garage, the ceiling panels caved down on the person who was renting a car, all that good stuff.
Oh my goodness.
All that bad stuff.
You guys just made up a word, heat tape. I've never heard of that before.
You've seen it. I'm sure you've seen it.
I have it on my house.
It looks like kind of goes like a V pattern, like up and down around the bottom, right above somebody's gutters.
Yeah.
And it's just, it puts just a tiny little trickle of electricity through that thing, and just enough to kind of keep the water from, or the heat from really building up, like right there above the gutters.
Yeah.
And it protects the gutters, and it kind of keeps ice dams in the gutters. I mean, ice dams above the heat tape. I've never seen heat tape that goes all the way up and down the roof line.
I live by the mouth of Big Cottonwood Canyon for doggone close to 30 years, and heat tape saved the day. You do have to remember, though, Dave, when you install it, to set a timer to remember to turn it off, because it runs on electricity, and it'll, your electric bill will pop up. So what, it's, for example, your buddy's house where they had all this ice damming, what does insurance cover in situations like that, and what does it not? And is it your homeowner's insurance that kicks in?
It is your homeowner's insurance, and ice dam coverage is part of a standard policy. Anytime I talk about insurance, I would like to caveat two things. One, I'm not an insurance expert. I've done a lot of reporting on it, but you should talk to your agent. And the number two thing is, when I do talk to agents about this to get answers for the various disasters that we cover, they all put in the caveat of, this is the general rule with a general standard policy, but you know, there can be exceptions to all these things. But anyway, the short answer to your question is yes. When it comes to ice damming, that is generally covered, as is the weight of snow on your roof. It's a huge pain if all of a sudden it
– Well, it's an emotional roller coaster too when you look up there and you see all that snow. Yep. You have to wonder. But if it were to collapse, or a carport collapses, that would be something on a homeowner's insurance policy?
Carport can be different. That's where it gets goofy.
It's not attached to the home generally, right?
It depends, right? It's auxiliary. So, you know, does your homeowner's insurance even cover your garage? It might. Mine does, but I added that on, right? And I have a detached garage. So yes and no. Carport, anything auxiliary. So fences, that sort of thing. And this, by the way, this would also go for snow in the tree. That big branch that's hanging over your fence that you've been meaning to cut back now for 3 or 4 years. If that thing falls down, that's also covered if it lands on your house. But if it lands on your carport, on your fence, unless you have special coverage for those auxiliary things, your pool, you may be out of luck.
I've got one of those. I got one of those branches. It is. You could see it's cracked.
Yeah,
you can see your face when he said that.
Man.
Like, I'm that dude.
Not gonna work.
I'm that dude. So what about?
Fall on the house, baby.
Poor Dave is white as a ghost.
So what about a shed? Kind of the same thing as a carport.
Yes.
Okay.
It depends on if it's covered. But again, auxiliary.
Some of these sheds are thousands of dollars. I didn't have mine was like $500 at the big box store, and it was a snap together thing.
Yeah, the plastic one you got down at Costco.
It withstood years and years and years of snow. So, but some of these are thousands. You drive into the Home Depot parking lot, and they've got shed row lined up at the back there. I'm like, who's affording $8,000 for these things?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and if it's your pool house, or if it's your, if you are someone who's affording $8,000 for these things because you've got the, you know, need to lock up your lawnmower or whatever the case may be, you should talk to your agent and make sure that is covered if that's something you're worried about.
Okay, sorry, let's go back to these terms you guys are throwing out that no one is – I've lived here my entire life. Ice damming. What? How does this work?
Oh,
what is an ice dam?
Goodness. Okay, start from the beginning.
Okay, so
– sorry, this should have been question number one when you guys were like, ice dam this and ice dam that.
Okay. It is a good question.
This should have been question number one when you had Kevin in. But the answer, as I understand it, is, you know, the roofing tiles – are warmer.
Yep.
You know, black is warmer than white.
Yes.
Right. When the sun reflects off it, and so roofing tiles are darker than the white snow.
Heat is going up through your roof.
Plus you got heat going up through your roof. Yeah. And so the heat gets on those tiles, and the heat then spreads, and then that causes, you know, melting and then refreezing and then melting and then refreezing as the temperature fluctuates right there above and below freezing or just below freezing, but the sun's maybe melting a little bit, and then that can create, you know, the same kind of layering that happens when we see avalanches and what have you. And so then what happens is you get these dams that prevent the water that's on the roof from being able to flow down to the gutters or flow off of your roof. And so it finds, water starts going backwards, and it gets under those tiles, those roofing tiles, and then it gets into your attic. It gets into your roofing area.
There's nowhere for the water to go because you have an ice dam there. Do you have large, huge icicles hanging off your roof, Dave?
No.
Okay, that's a good sign.
That's
because
a good
that means
sign.
You have good insulation. We had one house we owned where the icicles were like the stuff that fairy tales were made of, right? And the kids would we would knock it off, and then the kids would stand beside it when we would like measure their height based on the height of the icicle.
We call those the Great Impalers.
Yeah. We redid our attic insulation, but before we did, it was, you know, these things were used as lightsabers. Yeah, the kids all would sword fight with
so
them.
So dangerous.
Any
so
other
fun.
in the yeah. next 60 seconds, Matt? Any other takeaways regarding insurance and what's covered? When it comes to snow damage,
just the general rule, and I know you were just talking about flood insurance, but the general rule is if it makes it to the ground and then it melts and it gets into your home, it is probably not covered. But the basic rules are: snow on your roof, the weight from that snow, the water from that snow is probably covered. One thing that is not covered though is snow removal. So, you know, maybe it should be because they're paying a lot of money to cover the damage that comes from this stuff. But snow removal can be incredibly expensive when you're getting guys up on these pitched roofs, you know, wearing harnesses, hazard pay, thousands and thousands of dollars in some cases to get snow off your roof. But that is not an insured, a covered thing generally.
Only to have more snow in the forecast, too. So people are paying a lot of money.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Removal.
It's spring. It's spring. It snows over, right?
Matt Gephardt, you are living in an alternate universe, my friend. Matt Gephardt of KSL 5's investigative unit in the house with us this morning to walk us through what he found when he dove into insurance coverage and snow damage. You can find all of Matt's amazing work at KSLTV.com. Thanks,
that,
Matt.
That rule of thumb was incredible. You know, once it hits the ground and seeps into your house, you're probably in trouble. That's going to land on you. But as long as it is, I guess, on your roof, then you probably have some coverage. But again, check with your insurance folks.
Straight ahead, the GOP, the Republican Party, certainly in a unique position as we are on indictment and now arrest watch for former President Trump. We got House Speaker Kevin McCarthy calling it purely political at a GOP meeting in Orlando, Florida. Let's listen.
It's not here that we're coming to defend President Trump. What we're coming to defend is equal justice in America. And I think every American believes in that.
Obviously, that wasn't Kevin McCarthy, but that was from a news conference at a meeting of the Congressional Institute. We're going to dive more into this conversation with University of Utah political science professor James Curry on the role of Congress in a grand jury indictment. Is there one?
Dave and Dujanovic, special coverage of the top national story.
Well, we know through his post on Truth Social that former President Donald Trump believes that he'll be arrested any moment today. It all stems from this $130,000 hush money payment that went to adult film star Stormy Daniels after an alleged affair took place in 06. I just want to bring our listeners up to speed. I'm not seeing that there's been any arrest made so far, Dave.
Yeah, presidents over the years, not just President Trump, they've had very public scandals. And when it comes to their personal lives, I think of John F. Kennedy, and he was infamous for his cheating, most notably his affair with Marilyn Monroe, Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton. Also in Paula Jones, he paid $850,000 to Paula Jones. You'll remember that from the Washington Post report. To drop a sexual harassment lawsuit. Now we have the former President Trump and Stormy Daniels. But I think the question we're asking is, at what point does it cross the line from scandal to criminal?
Well, we're going to get Jim Curry, who's a University of Utah Associate Professor of Political Science, to talk more specifically about the role of the House or Congress at all in this. The Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. Professor, are you there?
I'm here. How are you
Hi.
Doing?
Hi. Good. Welcome to class. we always appreciate you being at the front of the room for these discussions. So House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, he had this to say about the allegations made by the Manhattan DA that are now sitting before a grand jury in New York.
You can go through lawyer after lawyer after lawyer. We'll tell you this is the weakest case out there. Trying to make a misdemeanor a felony. The timeline doesn't work because it's too long past. And doing it after a person for political purposes.
And now Speaker McCarthy is talking about bringing this Manhattan district attorney in front of Congress to essentially defend his actions. Professor Curry, What's going on here? What do you make of this? And is there a role for Congress to play to step in?
I mean, this fits right into the narrative or one of the talking points that House Republicans have, like, since they've taken back the majority in the House in January, which is that Democrats and liberals are weaponizing the federal government to silence conservatives. In fact, they launched a whole select committee on this just to investigate allegations along these lines. And so when you have a district attorney who's, you know, like supposedly preparing to arrest a former president about a scandal and about charges that, you know, are clearly illegal, but like have happened with presidents both in the past, it's an easy line of attack. It's an easy way to like fit it into a talking point that the House Republicans have already had for the last several months.
I mean, do you think Congress should get involved in this from your level of expertise, or is this just one they should leave alone and let the process work?
I mean, I think, you know, like all else equal, you should generally let the legal process play out. But, you know, this is politics. And you're going to, you, when you have a House majority, when you have a House party that are where this fits right into their political talking points, they're going to get involved. They're going to hold hearings. Those hearings would probably not be any sort of serious hearings that would lead to any sort of specific outcomes on legislation or anything like that. But it's a way to try to score political points and continue to try to hammer Democrats on things like using the federal government to attack conservatives and to attack Trump.
What does it mean if a former president is arrested? And where my mind goes, I think back to Gerald Ford pardoning Richard Nixon. I want to play a little bit of his explanation. He made an address to the nation. Let me play a little bit of this from Gerald Ford.
Or someone must write the end to it. I have concluded that only I can do that. And if I can, I must.
And President Ford famously pardoned Richard Nixon. And the reason was is he thought the country needed to be able to move on. So, again, my original question, what do you make of it if a former president is arrested?
You know, it's really complicated in this case in terms of, like, what do we make of it? Because I think Ford's point was so clear and so good that what we don't want is to be dragging our former officials through legal proceedings that may or may not have to do with politics, because it can create the impression that in our country you can jail political opponents, you can jail people for doing things politically that you don't like. On the other hand, you also don't want a situation where you can say that certain people are above the law,
yeah,
right? And so you don't want to have a situation where, well, if you happen to be president now, it's okay for you to do things that are illegal. And it's a really tight line, really hard tightrope to walk, because you don't, either of those extremes is not good. And so this is a situation where someone's trying to walk that tightrope where Donald Trump, like, there's enough evidence that Donald Trump may have done something illegal, or perhaps he should be charged and face criminal charges in a trial and all the things that happened in our country. But on the other hand, you don't want the appearance of what the way House Republicans and other Republicans are presenting it as. You don't want the appearance that this is some sort of use of the legal process to attack political opponents. And so you see that tension inherent in the messaging that's happening today that goes right back to the type of decision that Gerald Ford had to make back in the 1970s.
Professor Jim Curry, thank you for joining us from the University of Utah. He teaches political science there. Thanks.
Thanks, Professor. No sooner did I say what I said yesterday in our conversation with Boyd at 11:05 about if I were Governor Ron DeSantis, or if I were advising Governor Ron DeSantis to stay out of it. Do not attach yourself in any way to what is going on between the Manhattan DA and President Trump. And we stepped out of studio and we got an alert that DeSantis had said something.
I have no interest in getting involved in some type of manufactured circus by some Soros DA.
Yeah, but he did go after the DA on it, sort of standing up to in some regard for President Trump. I was surprised. I was like, just stay out of it. Why are you going to roll around in the mud on that one?
But what's very interesting about this, and very unique, because obviously whether it's Ron DeSantis, whether it's Mike Pence, who will both likely run for president against or at least vie for the nomination against President Trump. Typically, this is a situation when you have an opponent struggling or floundering or flapping around in the water, drowning politically, where you just let it happen and probably try to push them down and right. pile on a little bit.
Right.
But they're in a unique situation where is if you do that against the former president, you very well could lose his base. And that base is a must. You must have that base if you have any chance of winning the nomination. So they're in this weird world where they have to defend him.
Well, I don't know.
But
it
kind of shoots themselves in feet, in their foot.
Yeah, I just why did just say nothing?
You can't. They want President Trump is demanding that Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis come out and support them. And
therefore, the talking point is attack the DA.
Yeah.
Attack the DA. Attack the legal system. Talk about it being a political war game. Yeah. I mean, I guess it kind of feels like they're checking a box. Right?
You're right.
Checking a box. We talked about it.
But
if
it weren't President Trump, people would pounce and bury this candidate. They would bury this candidate politically because it helps them. They can't do it, though. And that is so strange.
Straight ahead, we're going to dive into credit card debt when we go right on the money. Average credit card debt across America right now is almost $6,200. Do you have a credit card with points or with cash back rewards?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A couple.
That's just the beginning of the problem that we're going to dive into next.
Right on the money. Special coverage with Dave and Dejanovic.
So you got a credit card because you fell in love with their rewards program, right? But I'm looking at this news release from creditcards.com. Dave, we're going to speak to Ted Rossman in just a moment about it. Look at all the stuff that's getting left on the table that folks aren't spending. So you get $300 or more in cash back or gift cards not being spent. Free hotel stay. You aren't taking up, you aren't cashing in on the reward. Free flights, not cashing in on that reward. Kind of defeats the purpose of getting a credit card with some sort of reward system.
The one I remember the most, I had gathered and saved up for years and years. And this is what it bought me. Two nights, hotel in Paris. That was it.
That's memorable.
It was two nights. This was years of saving up points, and I got two free nights in Paris.
39 million rewards credit card holders didn't redeem any rewards in the past year. Wow.
That doesn't totally surprise me, and I don't think it's as crazy as it sounds, because a lot of people, I think, save them up even for years to go to Disneyland. We've done that. Save them up to go to Paris. We've done that. We hoard them like Smaug the Dragon, like Dragon's Hoard. We hoard these points because when we use them, we want to make sure it's for the best thing ever.
Ted Rossman, senior industry analyst with Bankrate. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what is the deal? What's the excuse for not using the reward?
The biggest excuse is that people are saving up for a specific future redemption, which I guess I understand. I mean, yeah, you may have a specific trip in mind. The problem, though, is just like we've talked about before with gift cards, a lot of people have unused value just sitting around. In the case of gift cards, it's an average of $175 a person. I think for credit card rewards, it could be a lot more than that. And the problem is that these points and miles do lose value over time to inflation, to program changes. Maybe that 50,000 mile flight today is going to cost you 60,000 next year.
Oh, so true.
The point is you want to earn and burn strategically.
Hold on. Earn and burn. Did you come up with that yourself? Because I'm going to put that on a bumper sticker.
I can't take credit for that one. Yeah, some people in the credit card reward space talk about that. But, it's true. It's different from, let's say, your 401k where, yeah, you'd love to be a millionaire. You don't want to be a points millionaire. I mean, you want to earn these, but you want to actually use them as well.
Ted Rossman, a senior industry analyst at Bankrate.com.
And comedian. So Ted, what, when you say use them strategically, earn and burn, do you think just like what, set a reminder to check our points every few months, make sure that we're spending those points, or if we have got a gift card coming to us that we're turning around and not stuffing it in the back of our wallet and letting it rot there?
Yeah, all of that. You know, I really view these programs as inflation busters. You know, you think about travel, of course, or even just everyday stuff. Groceries, for example. I have a credit card that gives 6% cash back at the grocery store. If you're using cash or debit on groceries and you switch to this card, I mean, that right there saves you 6% on everything that you buy. The key is to pay in full and avoid interest. We don't want to be paying 20%, which is the average credit card rate, and just getting 1 or 2 or even 5 or 6% in rewards. But where these programs really work for you is if you're paying in full, avoiding interest, then it's free money. And cash back is very simple and universal. Travel's probably more lucrative, but a little more complicated. But it becomes personal preference at some point.
Is there a favorite reward system, point system that gets used?
Cash back is definitely America's favorite credit card reward. What's interesting, though, is that travel is probably more lucrative on a cents per point or mile basis, but you need to do a little more work. You need to find the optimal redemptions. You need to have the flexibility to travel on the right dates. Yeah. That's where, you know, a lot of times people ask me, what's the best credit card? Of course, it depends on your individual habits, but I would offer a no annual fee, 2% cash back card, like the Citi Double Cash or Wells Fargo Active Cash. I think that's a strong suggestion for the masses, you know, because that could be your only card and that's a pretty solid return. It could be a foundation and then you add other cards that do even better in certain categories. Most people don't want to be overly complicated with this, so that's where I think that's an especially good option.
Ted Rossman, can we take you into the bonus round real quick before we let you go? He's with Bankrate.com, having him on the line after seeing this news release that went out regarding folks that are just either not or forgetting to redeem their cash back or their rewards points they get through a credit card program. I'm just wondering if there's still any 0% credit cards out there for folks who may feel like they're in over their heads right now and want to make a balance transfer. With interest rates the way they are, we're sitting on the cusp. Tomorrow, we're expecting the Fed to announce whether they're going to raise interest rates yet again. Do you have any suggestions?
I do. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, too, because rewards are fun, but we should talk about the other side of it, because it's roughly half and half, cardholders who carry debt versus those who pay in full. So if you pay in full, go for rewards. If you have credit card debt, no shame, a lot of people do, get one of these 0% balance transfer cards. You could avoid interest for up to 21 months with the cards like the Bank AmeriCard, Wells Fargo Reflect, Citi Diamond Preferred. The competition here is pretty robust, and it's actually surprised me how generous these offers have remained despite higher rates. There's no free lunch, of course. After the term, the rate goes way up. But do your best to pay before the clock runs out. It could save you a lot of money in interest.
Ted Rossman, thank you for joining us. Earn and burn, that is what I'm taking away from this. Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time with us. Ted Rossman, a senior industry analyst at Bankrate.
We've got breaking news. Kate Davis running in from the newsroom right now. Shows a development regarding the death penalty, and is this regarding Lori Vallow?
Yeah, Debbie, exactly. We've just gotten this breaking update from East Idaho News that the judge in this case has granted a motion to take the death penalty off the table. So that means that Lori Vallow Daybell will not be eligible for the death penalty at this point. And again, Lori Vallow is being tried for the murder of her two youngest children. Mm-hmm. That's the case that's been ongoing for a very long time now. And again, the death penalty is off the table.
Well, that's a big development. Kate Davis, thank you so much for running in here with us. I knew that there had been some movement up in Idaho regarding that request, but now we are learning. Kate Davis just reporting that the death penalty has been removed in the case involving the mom, Lori Vallow Daybell. But my understanding is, I think this trial, and I don't know for sure, I think this trial starts in April. Dave, we're going to check into all of that and bring ourselves up to speed on where things are at. But I think that's a pretty big development in this case.
And you'll remember Chad Daybell, her husband, is well charged with the murder of the two children. I think J.J. Vallow was 7 years old. Tylee Ryan was 16 years old, two of Lori's children. And yeah, we've followed this story for a long time, but an interesting development that the death penalty has been taken off the table. You'll remember that Lori Vallow has kind of gone in and out of competency that's been questioned. That's why it's taken so long, I think, to really bring this trial about.
Jury selection begins just a matter of days, March 27th, so the end of this month, and the trial is set to begin the first week of April. We'll continue to follow that development right here on KSL News Radio.
Dave and Dujanovic have inside sources.
Republicans are wrong about Democrats. And Democrats are wrong about Republicans. That is what Governor Spencer Cox told students at Tooele High School. He was there yesterday to kick off his Connecting Utah tour.
Yeah, the Connecting Tour is when Governor Cox visits all 29 counties, meets with students, meets with residents. And that was the line that stood out to me. For all the things I've heard recently from the governor, this one resonated. Republicans are wrong about Democrats, and Democrats are wrong about Republicans. And I wonder how many Republicans and Democrats would agree with that statement.
Depends on if they're being honest or not.
Yeah.
If they're being honest, you do have to agree with it. And actually, it's just true. So if you look at it in terms of the demographics and look at the statistics, Pew Research did a deep dive on this not too long ago, and they really are the same. So if you look at a basic Democrat and a basic Republican, they're living in the same kind of neighborhood with the same kind of family structure, with the same kind of job. So there's actually very little difference in terms of their everyday lives. It's these little pieces of politics that we allow to dominate the narrative and actually drive the wedges where we think, oh, they're crazy, or oh, no, the other side's crazy.
And that was the point that Governor Cox was making, saying the only people we hear, the only Republicans we hear are the 10% most extreme. The only Democrats we hear from are the 10% most extreme. Said everybody else, you know, it's maybe not in the same section at a stadium, but they're in the same ballpark at least.
Yeah, for sure. And I would actually say the numbers are a little smaller. That's more like 3% on each end of the
they're
extreme.
They're just super, the 3%
super loud.
Is super loud.
They're
yeah.
super loud. And we amplify them. We amplify them in our own conversations. We mm-hmm. amplify them in the media. We amplify them on cable news. And so a part of it is we reward bad behavior, which is again, another way that we end up driving wedges, or we allow this performative politics of the extremes keep us a safe distance from having the conversation on all the areas where we actually agree.
I'm looking at a New York Times poll from last fall, so fairly recently. We've already pretty much gotten through a lot of the headbutting over the pandemic. We've been knee-deep in inflation by the time this poll is done. On and on. We can go over the list of all the things that have happened on the political front. But interestingly, 48% of those polled said that knowing a person's political views told them either a lot or a little about whether someone was a good person. That is shocking to me. So you're basing whether you think somebody is a good person or not, you're judging them mm-hmm. based on what their party affiliation is yep. or isn't.
Yeah, which is scary.
Yeah, that's almost half.
Yeah. And so you think
you don't even have a chance. So in a room of three people, I wouldn't even have a chance with one of you.
Yeah.
You would think I was a terrible person based on where my political affiliations lie. That's right. That's nuts.
It is nuts. And we've allowed the nuts to drive the train for a really long time. And sadly, that's, again, preventing us from, one, recognizing that the vast majority of this country, vast majority, is center left to center right. Almost everybody fits in that space. And there are so many conversations we can have in that space. But we've allowed the noisy extremes of the politics not just to be loud and noisy, but to actually influence our behavior to what you're talking about, Debbie. And that is that suddenly it is an us versus them. And the moment you start us versus them, then you open the gate for contempt to slide in. And suddenly it's not enough that I'm right and you're wrong. It's I'm good and you are evil. And that's where the real problem begins, because contempt. So contempt is that belief in the worthlessness of another person because they disagree with you. And so if I disagree with Dave and I have contempt for Dave, I can say anything I want about Dave. I can blow up his social media. I can melt down his Facebook. I can attack his Twitter. And I can still sleep at night and go to church on Sunday and feel good about myself because he's evil.
He's the problem.
Yeah.
Well, at least in that scenario. In that scenario.
I hate this metaphor. Okay. Let's use a different one. Let's turn on Debbie.
Let's talk about Debbie.
Let's talk about Debbie.
Enough of that.
I'm an equal opportunity offender. That's Debbie will be the next example.
Up next. Okay, so if we are agreeing with the governor where he says Republicans are wrong about Democrats and Democrats are wrong about Republicans, where do we come together? If we really are center left, center right, if there's more in common, what are some things genuinely that we could agree on that you think could, where we could get something done versus just afraid to say anything because we're going to get nuked by our.
Yeah. And you totally nailed it, Dave. It's that being afraid that we're going to get attacked if we agree with someone from a different political party or someone on the other side of the political aisle. And it's that courage. It's that courage. It's the old Harry Potter. You know, it's one thing to yell at your enemies. It's another thing to tell your friends that they're wrong. And I think one area where we can do that, and we could do it today, we could do it in an afternoon, is immigration. It was the most baffling thing to me when I went back to Washington, D.C. as a chief of staff, was we sat in a room and everybody agreed. Democrats, Republicans, everybody agreed. Everyone knows we need to have a border because we are a country. So we need to have a secure border. We need to have a way to tell who comes in and who goes out. I mean, if Disneyland can tell you, Dave, where your kids are at any point in time in the park for a three-day period, surely the greatest country on earth can figure out who comes in and who leaves the country. Everyone knows we need to fix the H-1B visas and those who do just want to come here and work. And make the system easier to come in legally than to come in illegally. Everybody agrees on all of that. But what we allow is the noisy edges to say, but Debbie, what about the what about the 10 million people who are here illegally already? Here's where the courage and the trust comes in. So let's say there are 10 million. I don't know what the number really is. I don't think anybody really knows. But let's say 10 million are here illegally. And if we do all these other things that everybody agrees on, that number would shrink to maybe 3 million. And out of those 3 million, maybe half of them are thugs and bad guys. And you know what? I trust the American people. We know what to do with thugs and bad guys. And the other half are very sympathetic cases. And you know what? I trust the American people to know what to do. No one's more compassionate than the United States of America. And so we could deal with all of that and have that done. And it would be a great model to say, look, we can do that. There's also more agreement than you think on things like Social Security and Medicare. But everyone's afraid to talk about it.
We say that's a liberal plan or that's a conservative plan, and we don't look really much past that.
Oh, every third tweet from President Biden is, the Republicans are coming after Social Security.
MAGA Republicans.
The ultra MAGA super duper Republicans are coming after your Social Security, and I will veto that. Like, there's no way this possibly happens, number one. It couldn't get through Congress in a million years, but it's a talking point, and it's very divisive.
Yeah, and it takes courage. And Republicans do the same thing of the, you know, liberal left, whatever.
Say, what do you say? Equal opportunity.
Yeah.
Offenders.
And so Republicans are equally guilty of doing the same thing and using all of the pejorative statements before they ever say anything about anyone. And again, that just prevents us from getting where we need to be, which is let's get together and solve some problems. And there's a different way to do that, but it all starts with this willingness to get to know the other side and to sit down and to understand where they're coming from and why. And just a 30-second example, Mia Love had an amazing conversation with one of her Democratic colleagues, and they got along really well. They were part of the Congressional Black Caucus. They walked away from a State of the Union, and he looked over at Mia Love and said, "I can't understand why you're a Republican. Tell me about that." And she said, "My family grew up in Hades. big national government prevented them from being entrepreneurs, and they were in control. And so I think a limited government's better. And then she said, well, so why are you a Democrat? I don't get it. You seem rational and normal. And he said, well, I grew up in the South. And in the South, it was the local government that was causing the problems for my uncles and for my people that were being arrested and all of those kinds of things. So it was the federal government that came in and saved the day. And suddenly they had this understanding of each other. The Democrats weren't wrong. The Republicans weren't wrong. Different experiences, it allowed them to come together on some pretty great legislation as a result.
Boyd Matheson, thank you. Great conversation. I thought it was a really insightful comment from the governor and definitely worth diving into. So thanks, Boyd. You can hear Inside Sources today from 1 to 3.
Straight ahead, we're going to dive back into our conversation. What's going on in the Davis County School District where someone wants to ban the Bible? District spokesperson Chris Williams calling the show. We're going to ask him lots of questions like, how long is it going to take to make a decision? How many committees do they have reading the Bible? Are people reading this the 1,200-page Bible in order to see if it needs to stay on library shelves or be banned?
Dave and Dujanovic. Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top local story.
There's a challenge to the Bible. The Bible. 1,200-page historical book. That's the most published book in all of history.
Yeah, you probably don't need to describe that one.
Being challenged by the Davis School District. The reason I did bother to describe it is because somebody has to read it in order to decide whether it is worthy of staying on library shelves in the Davis School District or be banned.
Whether or not it is appropriate. Holy moly, are you serious? Are we talking about the Bible? Like, seriously, the Bible. Now, if someone has a problem with the Bible, how about the Quran? How about the Book of Mormon? Like, which religious books are allowed and which are not?
Chris Williams, the Director of Communications and Operations at the Davis School District, live on the line. So, at hand right now, the challenge is specifically for the Bible, not the Book of Mormon or the Quran, correct?
Right. And let me first say, many people in the Davis School District are wearing mismatched socks today because we are commemorating or being aware of Down Syndrome Day in the school district. So a lot of us are wearing mismatched socks. So based back to your question, the Davis School District is not asking whether the Bible is something that should be kept on the shelves. Someone else has requested that. And so that's why we're looking at the Bible. We have 80 other requests of books, and we treat each one of those requests
the same?
The same sort of criteria. We look at the law, we determine whether it's in violation of the law, we move forward.
Okay, so what happens if somebody has a problem with a book? Whether it's the Bible or any other book, what do they do?
So let me specifically talk about the Bible. We ask the person to let us know where they think the violations are. The person has submitted 49 pages from the Bible. So the committee starts looking at where those violations are, whether it be the Bible or any other book. And then they start determining, they look at Utah Code 7610-1227 that talks about pornographic or harmful materials within our publications, and they see whether that bright line exists. If that bright line exists, if those violations are there, then the committee meets and decides whether the book is removed. If they don't find that, then they go to another level and determine whether the book is age appropriate, whether there's violence, whether there's other challenges in the book that requires us to consider removing it.
Chris Williams is the Director of Communications for the Davis School District. He's live on the line with us. Deseret News and also KSL.com broke a story last night, and you can see it at either one of their websites regarding a challenge to the Bible, specifically in the Davis County School District. as to whether it should stay on the shelves or be removed from the shelves. And so when you said 49 passages have been identified by the person who right now we don't have a name of, have been cited as potentially offensive or fitting within the guidelines of Utah state law, do the people who are in charge of the or sitting on this committee, do they have to read the entire book to see what context those passages are in as someone is reading it in its entirety? Or is it just the passage that's on the radar?
Yeah, I mentioned 49 pages, not passages.
49,
so they
okay.
look at that Utah code to see if those 49 pages violate that code. If they find it violates it, then they move to remove. If they do not find it violates it, then they go to read the entire book to see if it violates anything else regarding vulgarity, regarding violence, whether it's age appropriate, and then they make that determination.
Does this feel at all like a statement, like challenging the Bible?
That isn't a question that we're answering. We have to look at every single request on its own merits and handle each one of them the same. We have to look at the law. We just don't have the ability to say this is silliness or what have you, because every person has the right to submit a request, and every request should be handled in the same way.
A couple questions. How large is this committee? Who makes up this committee? And is this a volunteer committee, or are they paid?
We started off with 11 committees specifically just for reading these requests, reading these books. Those committees grew to 16. Nine of those committees have reviewed the books they were originally assigned and have said, thank you very much for allowing us to participate. Our work is done. So right now we have seven active committees. And so they're made up of a librarian who serves as the chair of the committee, as well as a school administrator, as well as a minimum of three parents who have standing, which means that they have students who are part of that school community. And those are the individuals who make up a committee that typically is about seven people. It can't be any less than five people. The individuals do get a very small stipend, and I say small based on the amount of work that they put into it. Many of these people have jobs that they have to do every day. A lot of the work takes place after hours and on weekends.
Chris, I'm just curious, do you have any idea at all? Can you ballpark how many kids are flocking to check out the Bible from the schools in the Davis County School District?
That is a great question. I don't have the answer to that one.
A waiting list for the Bible? Okay. And how much longer till we hear how the Bible, if the Bible survives or gets kicked to the curb there in the district?
Yeah, we do have typically a 60-day window. If that window needs to be expanded, then we contact a requester to let them know that we need more time. So I couldn't give you an estimate, really, of how long that work may take. One thing I do want to make sure I say, though, any parent always has the ability to contact administrators at the school and let them know that they don't want their child to have access to certain books. Less than 10 parents across the district have made those requests so far.
Wow.
While these books are being challenged, are they removed?
While they're being challenged, they are not removed. If a decision is made to retain or remove a book, that's when those books either
it's got to go through
removed.
The process, though.
Yeah, they
first.
Have to go through the process, no question.
Okay. Chris Williams, thank you for joining us. Director of Communications and Operations for the Davis School District.
Straight ahead, we're going to go live to New York for News Nation. They're going to jump on the line with us again today. They're keeping us posted on where the Manhattan District Attorney and the grand jury stand regarding the possibility of indicting President Trump or not.
Dave. Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top national story.
And once again today, we are on President Trump Watch. Of course, we know that he put out on a social media platform, True Social, that he was expecting to be arrested today. I want to bring our listeners up to speed. He hasn't been arrested yet today. We don't even know if it's going to happen today, but in a moment we're going to go live to New York. We're going to get the latest from News Nation on where the grand jury is at.
I just saw a headline from MSNBC from the GOP committee chair who said, "We're all exhausted by the Trump drama." And I thought, how many Americans, how many Utahns right now feel that exact same way? Just exhausted by the Trump drama. Now, that being said, how much of that is President Trump's fault and how much of it is the Democrats or the people that are going after, constantly going after President Trump?
I'm looking forward to having another conversation today with News Nation's national correspondent, Robert Sherman, who has been in New York. You still in New York waiting to see what the grand jury decides to do if they hand up an indictment?
Indeed, I am sitting outside the courthouse now, and we're all eagerly waiting to see what's going to happen here next.
Any sense? Does your spidey sense tell you anything?
You know, spidey senses being a couple of sources that we have here tell us that we're not going to get an indictment to come down today. That's kind of what we're hearing. And, you know, to walk through the timeline of events, you would need the former president would need to be indicted first before he would be, quote unquote, arrested, before he would be brought in and processed and have to go through the arraignment. So if that's not happening today, then the arrest that he's been talking about is not going to happen either. And I think that it's really worth hammering home here that the only person who has said that Donald Trump is going to be arrested today was Donald Trump himself. Neither the district attorney's office nor his own legal counsel have been able to corroborate that claim. So I think that that's a really important piece of context here. In terms of, you know, where we go from here, it's up in the air. So, I mean, this is going to be in the hands of the grand jury, which still has to make a vote. And the way that this works is that there are 23 people on the grand jury. 12 of them have to vote in favor of the indictment in order for the former president to be indicted. We heard from his legal counsel a couple of days ago who said that if he had to be a betting man, he would say, yeah, probably the 45th president would be indicted. That's not the same as a conviction, however. I mean, there's still a long way to go throughout this whole process. But a fairly significant development happened yesterday in which we heard from one witness testimony, Robert Costello, a former attorney for Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen is the key witness for the prosecution in this case. He was Mr. Trump's former fixer. And he testified saying Michael Cohen is not a credible source, claiming that he's on a revenge tour, claiming that Michael Cohen would say anything to get out of jail before because he went to jail. Now he has this vendetta, says that he's just not the ideal kind of witness to be pinning the hopes of this entire case upon. That's what he had to say, you know, to the grand jury. So we don't know if that's going to sway anybody. We don't know if that's going to have an impact. So I mean, it's really just the wait and see game at this point.
News Nation's national correspondent Robert Sherman live in front of the courthouse there in New York. We're waiting to see what the grand jury does. And I want to back up to the Michael Cohen connection, and that is critical. And that for our listeners who haven't been keeping track of this chess game, Robert, Michael Cohen is the one who had been accused and eventually served time for a transfer of $130,000 to Stormy Daniels, the adult film star that has alleged that she had an affair or some sort of encounter that was of a intimate nature with the former president back in 2006. So we're talking, you know, 15, 16, 17, I can't even do the math, it's so long ago. And that's where Michael Cohen comes in as being a key, or as we said, star witness for the prosecution.
Yes, exactly. And that's why he's considered the star witness for the prosecutors, is because he was the person who was making this transaction happen. So he was the one who would have the intimate knowledge of how funds were used and things of that nature, what have you. So that's why he's the key witness here. And that's why you have folks in the former president's camp who are trying to discredit that witness, because so much of this case hinges upon what Michael Cohen has to say. So that's where a lot of this is coming from. I do think that an important point to note here as well is that, and I'm sure, you know, you're talking about a lot of your listeners being exhausted by the whole Trump drama. There are a lot of Republicans, supporters of the president, also people who aren't even fans of the president, who are calling this politically motivated prosecution. The district attorney here in New York on the campaign trail boasted that he had sued former President Trump over 100 times. This was something that he was saying en route to his victory here. So people are looking at this and saying, you know, how much of this is, you know, actually trying to uphold law, how much of this is politically motivated. That's where you're seeing the mudslinging take place here as all of this starts to come to a head.
I spent about 15 minutes this morning on Truth Social going through the former president's posts, and it was all about this. There was so much around this. But one of the lines he said, protest, take our nation back. Are you seeing any protests where you're at?
Good question. So we have seen a couple of small demonstrations happening here in the city, a couple of people waving flags on bullhorns, holding signs outside of Trump Tower, outside of the courthouse here as well. Nothing that has gotten pretty significant, however. I mean, nothing, you know, close that would cause any concern. I will tell you that, of course, the New York Police Department is trying to get ahead on this as much as possible. They released a statement saying that they're going to have a heightened presence here of uniformed law enforcement officers in all five boroughs, but they don't see any credible threats to New York City at this point. And we know that when it comes to security, I mean, that's going to involve not just local law enforcement, but also law enforcement at the state and federal level as well. But so far, it's been pretty quiet and pretty tame. Yeah, there have been a couple of shouting matches that we've seen, but nothing really out of the ordinary for demonstrations in New York.
In New York, Robert Sherman, thank you for joining us, News Nation's national correspondent.
Shouting matches. Sounds like Congress. We'll keep an eye on that. Thanks so much to News Nation. We had two reports live from then. We had earlier in the 9 o'clock hour, we had Brian Enten from News Nation, who was camped outside Mar-a-Lago in Florida, and then Robert Sherman, who is camped outside the courthouse in New York. We've got the bases covered.
And Robert Sherman made a good point. He said the only person that has whispered the words arrest is the former president himself.
I think he did it in all caps, too.
Yeah, it was all caps,
exactly,
for sure.
A whisper. Straight ahead. I'm curious to know, do you have joint bank accounts? Do not answer that question yet, David. Hold the phone.
Then don't ask it.
Let's dive into this headline straight ahead and go right on the money. Are joint bank accounts good for your marriage?
Right on the money. Special coverage with Dave and Dejanovic.
I want to take a peek inside of Dave's financial world with his wife. Do you guys... Okay, basically...
No secrets here.
Like the way you laughed, you're like...
Come up later, I'll tell you my social security number.
And the way you laugh.
My credit card number.
I knew exactly where this is going. It's like, Deb, I have no say, so I have no comment in what we're about to talk about over the next 8 minutes. The question
on
that we're
advice
asking,
of counsel, I've been.
This comes to us from Berkeley. And the headline is, are joint bank accounts good for your marriage? So, first question is, do you have a joint bank account that you're allowed access to participate in?
Oh, that's a great qualifier there. That's a very, very important qualifier. Do I have a joint bank account? Yes. Do I have access to that joint bank account?
Like you don't have a PIN number?
It's an entirely different thing. I don't have my own card.
Oh, no.
I have to ask permission to use it.
Okay, quick backstory. Did something happen?
Okay, in defense of my wife's totalitarian use of our joint bank account, the autocrat that is my wife.
I love all of this. I love all of
this. I may have taken advantage at times over the years of the joint bank account.
We call that freelancing.
I may have not A, communicated purchases, B, authorized purchases.
Oh, you never got them authorized. And usually these are major drop of the hat purchases, right? These aren't something that have been planned out for a while. You can say, well, I sent you a text 6 months ago and now I'm just buying those $800 tires.
No. It was never the $800 tire that I got in trouble.
You dimed your way out of your bank account.
Oh, I don't remember eating it in and out four times last week.
According to new research, it is better for married or couples that are together to combine their financial resources. You're happier than those who don't.
I don't know if that's entirely true. That's sure. been probably one of the big fights of our marriage is my freelancing.
Oh, you freelancing out and spending that In-N-Out burger. Well, traditionally, according to the article, newlywed couples pool their money together into joint accounts. But these days, especially millennials, choosing to keep their accounts separate. And so each participant in that relationship retains control over their own money.
How does that work? Like, listen, mine was a disaster. I mean, I'm terrible. I am untrustworthy with the joint bank account. But how does separate accounts work better?
Well, so let me ask you this. Riddle me this. Back it up. What do you do now for money? You just wander around the side? I mean, you...
Deb, you want to buy me lunch?
You kind of do some of that.
I'm so hungry.
Well, so what do? You have your own little pool of money?
I get an allowance.
Here. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that allowance has ebbed and flowed over the years. I think my current allowance is zero.
Oh.
But no, yeah, it's tricky, right?
Don't look at me. Steve Harvey. You know Steve Harvey.
The comedian.
Yeah, but he's
Is he joking about this?
No, I don't think so. He actually has a lot of food for thought and things that he says and things that could be made into bumper stickers. This may be a bumper sticker moment. He actually shared a lesson he learned on how couples should manage their money. He learned it from his financial advisor. Okay, take notes, Dave. He thinks that every married couple should have four accounts.
Every married couple should have four bank accounts. You should have a joint bank account. Out of that account, you pay all the household expenses and bills. After that's paid, you decide which percentage of that money should go into a savings account. In that savings account, it must require both of your signatures to move the money. Then you have a personal account and he has a personal account. He's not allowed to tell you what to do with your personal money. You're not allowed to tell him what to do with his personal money. Because even though you're married and you're a union, you still have to maintain some form of individuality so you can feel like a human being, you know.
That's fair.
No woman wants to go to her husband to ask for money to get her nails done.
And no guy wants to say, I need $10 for my pickleball fees. No guy wants to ask that. Though I've asked that three times last week.
Yeah. So let's listen to CNBC's David Bach. He said, financial experts back this up as well. He said this is especially true, sorry, Dave, for women.
Definitely have your own separate accounts, too. It's absolutely critical, especially for women. The reason it's so important for women to have your own money is that over 40% of marriages end in divorce. And it's almost always the woman that is hurt the most financially in divorce. So I want you having your own investment account. I want you having your own emergency account. I want you having your own credit score. I want you ultimately, as a woman in a marriage, to actually be the one who's in charge of all the finances.
Well, my wife does run the finances in our family. Mm-hmm. So she pays the bills. I turn the money over. Here it is. I sign it off. She gets it. And then she distributes it. And it's great for us. She's very detail-oriented. I am not.
So that works out well.
So it works out great.
But so you have your own little pool of money that you keep in whatever app or something like that, that if you need a little bit extra money. The article that we started this conversation with, Are Joint Bank Accounts Good for Your Marriage? One of the subtitles is Sharing Money Leads to Conversations. They surveyed 1,000 married couples about their relationship satisfaction and how they manage their financial resources. And then one of the things that came out of this study is it said, you know, we talk about it more because we are sharing the money, and that makes perfect sense. We did the route. We've done both routes. We did when we were married. One, we started things off where we both had our own individual accounts, and then it's like, 1 month, I don't know, he made the house payment and then I paid the utility bills and bought all the groceries. And the next month we flip-flopped and then it gets confusing and then you're trying. And ultimately what I found is it was hard for us to budget things that way. And it actually like led to more tense discussions because we didn't share a common microscope on the budget. My paycheck went into my account. His paycheck went into his account. And then it was like a toss-up as to who was paying what bills. I mean, We did a pretty good job of it. But then after a few months, it's like you lose track. And so we ended up with a joint account, which, as you experience, also brings on its own set of challenges. But I would definitely, if I had to vote, I'd vote for the joint account. There's certain things I would have done differently, maybe given him more of an allowance.
Yeah.
So he didn't have to beg me for $10 and pickleball fees like you have to do. But that's my take.
That would be my advice as well. I totally agree. I don't know how you could do it truly with separate accounts the way you described it. Like you got the mortgage, I got the utilities. That would just be a nightmare, I think. So ultimately, I think the joint account is a very good thing. But I totally agree with Steve Harvey there that you have to have a personal individualized count that I don't have to account for, that I don't need to tell. It's like, hey, give me the $100 a month, whether I spend it on In-N-Out Burger, pickleball, or, you know, throwing it in the wind. It does not matter. That is my money to lose. If I light it on fire and watch it burn in all its glory, that is my terrible decision to make.
Well, let's not let it go in the wind. Although if it does, have it blow my way. That's perfectly fine. Maria's up next. I can see her through the glass. I know she's got a lot of coverage today. We had that horrible accident involving a front runner train that we launched the show with. I know she'll have an update on that. Probably a lot more on Water Watch as well. More snow and rain in the forecast.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.